Good evening. Welcome. I'm Ava Raspini, Assistant Curator in the Department of Photography here at the Museum of Modern Art, and it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce Ronnie Horne this evening. Before I begin, I'd like to remind you to please silence your cell phones. Also, we have a sign language interpreter. If you need her assistance, there's a few seats in the front, and you can move up. Also, you can see we're pretty high-tech, and we have a live closed caption system as well. Just a quick note about the format for this evening. After my short introduction, Ronnie Horne will speak about her work. We will then have a moderated discussion and then open up for a Q&A for the audience. The evening should conclude at about 8 p.m. Ronnie Horne works fluidly in a variety of mediums and forms, from drawing to sculpture to photography to books. There are 46 works by Horne in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, as well as numerous artist books in our library's special collections. Horne cites free jazz as being instructive to her working methods. Just as musicians such as Coltrane attempted to break down the conventions of jazz, Horne similarly moves from medium to medium, mapping the myriad of connections between them. In this short introduction, I won't even try to map out her entire practice or to speak to the range of her artistic practice, but I'll touch briefly on a few works in the museum's collection, and hopefully it'll help illuminate some of her ideas and process. Horne was born in 1955 and grew up in Rockland County, which is north of New York City. In 1975, she graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design, and 3 years later, she received her Master of Fine Arts in Sculpture from Yale University. In 1975, she visited Iceland for the first time, and she returned there in 1978 for an extended journey where she crossed the island by motorcycle. Over the years, her mostly solitary experiences in the more remote landscapes of Iceland have become an important influence on her life and her work. In 1982, she spent 2 months in a lighthouse in southwestern Iceland, where she produced a series of drawings called Bluff Life, which are in MoMA's collection, and there's just a selection seen here on the screen. In other drawings, she builds elements and forms such as ellipses, spirals, and solid blocks of color using pigment on paper. She then cuts the paper into sections and shifts them around to suggest geological or tectonic action, evoking both the movement of the landscape and the construction of architectural space. And I just am flipping through a few that are in the museum's collection. Horne's conceptually based sculpture has a minimalist edge, as you can see in this 1991 sculpture titled Stephen's Bouquet. Her works have many aspects. While some seem to concentrate on problems of material, form, and space, others are based and entrenched in language and literature. Emily Dickinson is prominent among the literary influences in her work, as can be seen in this 1993 sculpture. Let me see. Which is titled How Dickinson Stayed Home. From the early 80s, Horne has also worked in photography and making books. Initially, her photographs were dedicated exclusively to her ongoing multi-volume publication, which is titled To Place, and which was begun in 1990, and which is about Iceland. In 1994, You Are the Weather became her first photographic installation, which was followed by Pi in 1998, a work based on imagery taken along the Arctic Circle in northern Iceland. Her 15-part photographic work, Stillwater, the River Thames, for example, from 1999, is currently on view in the Photography Collection Gallery on the museum's third floor. Photographed from a boat on the River Thames, this work describes the transience of water. The surface of the water in each image is dotted with numbers, which unfortunately you can't see in the slide, but I encourage you to look at the work in person. And these numbers correspond to a series of footnotes, which include the artist's stream of consciousness thoughts that mirror the fluidity of water, stories about the River Thames as a site for suicides, the poetry of Emily Dickinson, of course, and references to the film A Clockwork Orange, among many other references. I'm just going to read a few of the footnotes that I particularly enjoy from this work. What does water look like? Is water sexy? Have you noticed how light camouflages water? When you photograph water, you strip it of its form, of its restless, liquid reality. Going into water is going into yourself. Water is a mirror. But even in black water, there's a reflection, though a degraded one. You don't have to witness yourself in black water. What emerges from many of these footnotes is Horn's interest in both the transparency and the opaqueness of the water. These qualities that she describes, I think, are recalled in a recent sculpture untitled Aretha, which takes its title from the singer Aretha Franklin. This rough, rectangular block of solid glass in this gorgeous, deep red color evokes the minimalist form of her other sculpture. The transparency of the surface of the glass is like a window. And with it, she reveals to us what is lurking underneath the surface, which to me is an analogy that perhaps can be applied to many of her works. I'd like to conclude my comments by highlighting just some of Horn's many awards and exhibitions. Among them are 3 NEA fellowships, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the Alpert Award. She has exhibited widely in museums in Europe and the United States, including major exhibitions at the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the Castello di Rivoli in Turin, the Folkwang Museum in Essen, the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, the DIA, also in New York, and the Art Institute in Chicago, among many others. In 2009, the Tate Modern will open a retrospective of her work, which will travel to New York to the Whitney Museum of American Art. And now it is my great pleasure to hand over the podium to Ronnie Horn.
If you do me better than I do myself. Thank you. It's already a journey to think about what I might talk about when people ask me to speak publicly. I never know what I'm going to say or what I'm going to be interested in talking about. Of course, it's always going to be myself, but you know, there are so many different nooks and crannies. And I thought I'd dedicate this lecture to a recent work that was completed. Well, it's an ongoing permanent installation in Iceland called Vatnasop Library of Water. Some of you may know I've been traveling to Iceland since 1975. This is a work called Universal Rorschach. It's an aerial view of the entrance to the center of the Earth. And Jules Verne identified Snæfellsjökull, which is a glacier that sits on top of Snæfellsnes. I thought, you know, you could talk about Iceland and you can talk about the art and all of that. It's kind of dry in a way. Or I could talk about, you know, 30 years of sexual adventure in Iceland. I thought, you know, this is, you know, an art audience. They're not going to be interested in that. So I thought I'd get back to the ice. You know, we all know, and this isn't funny, but I got to keep it light. The ice thing is I'm entangled in my microphone. Ah, I think I have to keep the jacket on one way or the other. This ice, which is symbolically covering the entrance to the center of the Earth, is also disappearing. Now, I don't know what that means, whether we are about to arrive at a whole new level of discovery or loss. But if you follow Jules Verne, eventually you're going to arrive at the center of the Earth, and the center of the Earth is a sea that's kind of completely embroiled in a maelstrom. And this is part of a work I did in 1995 called Verne's Journey. You'll excuse me for a second while I disentangle myself from my technology here. All right. So center of the Earth. About 5 years ago, I started photographing on a river in southern Iceland. I've worked with water a lot in my life. I almost think water's worked with me a lot in my life. I'm not sure which way it goes. It's definitely a reciprocal interaction. This is a glacial river, meaning that it's melt from a glacier. It looks like concrete. People who live around it hate it. I loved it because it revealed itself, all of its fugitive moments, which were really like the most composed drawings I'd ever seen. So these photographs were taken literally of the river in action. And this is part of a work which was referred to, it's the ninth volume of Two Place. Two Place is the, as far as I know, it's the only Vanity Press encyclopedia ever published. So I gather these fugitive moments, and now this river has an enormous range of personality, and this is on another part of the river. This is in southern Iceland. So I was saying this is the ninth volume of Doubt Box. This is the ninth volume of Two Place. It's called Doubt Box, which consists of about 28 cards, two-faced cards. Now, I grew up in a world where I was taught that the photograph never lies. And I now live in a world where I would say the opposite is clearly true. And, of course, all of the images here have some glacial presence. This is all part of the Doubt Box. Now we get to the Library of Water, which is it's a permanent installation. I don't know what the word permanent means, but it's a long-term installation. It is a community center, in effect. About 2 hours outside of Reykjavik. I was approached about 5 years ago by Art Angel out of London. James Lingwood was extremely persistent in wanting to imagine a commission of my work somewhere in the world, and it was his first attempt to do an international commission. And as far as I know, it's the first. It is the first international Icelandic commission, Art Angel commission. What I turned James onto was this building here in this little town, Stykkishólmur. It's a community center. Originally, it was built as a library. And I think the thing that attracted me to this building was that it was placed at the high point of the town, and it was built as a library. I mean, even the church was on low ground compared to this library. And I think that set the tone for me. And I actually was attracted to the town for this building, which you get maybe a little bit of a sense of this. It's got a bit of a deco influence and a bit of a kind of a lighthouse design influence, which is typical of Iceland. Of course, the building was designed by a German, and it looks like it was built in the 30s, but in fact, it was built in the 60s. So here we have the library at the high point of town, and when I went there with James, the library was about to be moved to another location, and we were fortunate to, through the support of the federal government there and the local government, to be able to take over the building and turn it into what I think of as a kind of public art work, privately funded, which is the best public art because you don't have to compromise. So there's the community center. That's the building. We did renovate the building extensively. The community center which is functional as we speak, houses two new sculpture installations of mine, which were designed to frame the public space, to enable public activity in this space. And there are many other facets to this, but I thought I'd walk you through the production of the key piece in this community center, which is called Water Selected. I think I got a little bit of too much direction on my mic here. Is everybody hearing me okay? I don't want you to miss one word. Okay. Excellent. So here we are in Iceland. And you can see a little asterisk. Actually, I actually have a fantastic device here, which is could be a weapon, but is in fact a laser. This is the community center. Here's Reykjavik. There is the entrance to the center of the Earth. And just in case you weren't aware, down here you've got the entrance to hell. So you're really kind of, you got all the major kind of traffic going through there. And it's all of it within 100 miles, so you can, you know, really have quite a life. What you're looking at, all these little orange tags that you can't read, are the names of the sources of the water. I've got so many devices now, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. This is an archive of water. Water Selected is an archive of water. We collected from 24 glaciers in Iceland. 24 glaciers in Iceland. Those are the orange tags. Each glacier was eventually housed in a floor-to-ceiling glass column. So you're sort of seeing, I'm giving you a little preview of Water Selected. Let me start at the sources, though. We took the ice from throughout Iceland. This is Iceland as of a year ago. Now, Iceland, if you hit it right, could be Florida. The weather's changed dramatically. The feeling of the landscape and really what you do in the landscape has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. I think part of that's Iceland and part of that's the world. I didn't intend to make a work about global warming, but I don't think it's possible to do anything that isn't about global warming today, or at least it's not possible for me. So these are some of the sources of the actual ice. I had a crew of people who had quite an extraordinary relationship to Iceland in the sense they could access anywhere in Iceland. And most of Iceland has very few roads, so it was really a dancers in trucks. Really, I thought of it almost as a choreographic act to get into some of these locations. The tires are designed to move through, move over ice without damaging the landscape. You can drive these trucks. They have these huge tires. Can actually drive over moss without compromising the ground cover. This isn't an argument for driving in the landscape. This is just there are options to move about without destroying the place. So what we did was we found ourselves in these exquisite places, and we took 200 liters of ice, water as ice, and into these. This is actually one of my favorite glaciers because it's just so hideous and so disturbing. And this is part of the reason why I love to be in Iceland, because there's this kind of, you just feel like a criminal all the time and you didn't do anything. It's just perfect, you know? Your adrenaline's going and you're just like, and that's been my, you know, big part of my life. That's the reason why I haven't done too much damage yet. But this is this. A lot of the ice, it's interesting. You get black ice. Here we are cutting the blocks out. Here we are transporting the ice. Lot of different. I actually was shocked by what I saw, because you know you really had black ice, and then you had you know the classic, all different colors. I didn't have a clue what ice was till I went, you know, went out there and started to gather the water. We, you know, as is typical in Iceland, one of the things I find very endearing about Iceland is everything's improvised. So here we got the fish factories to help us store the ice around Iceland. So we're storing it in the fish, these are fish containers, you know. And so we had the ice stored around Iceland, and eventually, and then in the ice factory itself. And eventually, when we were ready to melt it, when we kind of set up the site for the water, we kind of got this pull. Paul McCarthy came to Iceland and helped me melt the ice. That's actually a lie, but every time I look at this photograph, I just think of him. I don't know how I found this location. Somebody found this location, and they got all these, you know, hoses attached, and it just looks pretty nasty. Black ice. Check it out. I mean, you know, this is not... I have not retouched these images. We had actually the geologic department at the university gave us this. Again, it was like a fish container, but we fitted it out with a melting device at the bottom, so you could pop the ice in the container, and the heat coils at the bottom would melt the ice over the day, and you'd load it into these drums of plastic drums for shipping. They're all nicely labeled. I think a lot about Walter Benjamin, who I don't know whether he was an influence on me, but I certainly carry his presence in my life. And I think, you know, the idea of archiving water is so extremely absurd. I think the only thing, in a way, more absurd is the fact that it seems necessary today. So here we are. We get into the lighthouse, a.k.a. community center. And, of course, you got this extraordinary view, which is, you know, full-on weather 24 hours a day. We load the water into the columns with pressurized gas. This is a shot of the ceiling, and the way the columns are held into the ceiling, they go into the ceiling, and they go into another sculpture of mine called "Weather." You Are the Weather, Iceland, which is a rubber floor. It's about 2 inches thick. So the glass column sits in this rubber floor, and it sits up in the ceiling. So here what you have is me kind of a design for the layout of the glass columns. So getting back to my implements here, you'll see the entrance is here. Here you're facing west, so here you've got all your windows. You walk in here, and all the green dots indicate the locations of the columns. So basically you enter into this kind of forest of water. And eventually, it opens up into a communal space here, which is where a lot of community activities are taking place. Here you have the sources of the water listed here, all the different glaciers, and the specific locations, the dates, and then you have, and this is an interesting thing, because in Iceland, you know, and perhaps this would be true anywhere. If you just walk in and you look at the water in the, this, you know, this technology, they say it works. I know nobody can hear me, you know. And these columns, you look at these columns and you think, what the hell is this, you know? It's just like, they all want to know where the water came from. They don't know, they don't know half the glaciers, but they want to know. So there was this kind of struggle between me not wanting to get didactic and the public wanting to know. So eventually I created this little diagram here, and we framed this thing, and we put it in the back room. You know, because even the boys who are collecting the water, can you all hear me without this mic? You can't. How about maybe this mic is better? All right, so the big, just so you know, when you go there and you want to impress the locals, you want to know that number 7 is Sneifels Yokel. And the community is very proud to have a piece of this glacier in their community. It also happens to be an unusually clear water. And we'll get to the appearance of water. I mean, there's this funny idea about water that it's like a rose is a rose is a rose, but it's not. So here's the entrance, and you go in, and there's your water. Some of it's actually still opaque. 6 months later, you get some opaque water. It's just not settling down. And some of it is just exquisitely transparent, even perhaps more transparent than air. You feel like an attenuation of the air when you look through this. You see this the quality of the clarity of the water. Try another angle on this. All right, so here we go into the installation. Now you've got that forest of columns that I was describing, and you're facing off into the direction of the west. You're standing at the entrance to the space. Now the columns are lit from above with a standard light bulb. And occasionally you get a little touch of Versailles in there. There are very Baroque moments, you know. It's very much a piece that exists in the dark and in the light. The community has 24-hour access to this space. It is used in many different ways. There are many little secrets about this space that I've observed when I go up there, and one of them is this kind of doubling of the view that occurs in the columns. Or you get this folding of the landscape or the surround into the column, which is quite an exquisite thing. Or you get, you know, a fabulous kind of Frankenstein effect. This is my Frankenstein moment. But it's a piece that has many personalities depending on the hour of the day. And then you've got a lot of activity coming and going, people coming and going, students, local students coming in to, actually there were a number, I was very proud of this, the elementary school sent the students out to collect water and meet up at the Library of Water so they can compare notes. I don't know what they talked about, but it seems pretty philosophical. But actually, what you can see in this photograph, the differences in the water. Not that I want to make a point of this, but, you know, I was kind of surprised. Actually, everybody was kidding me. Can't we just go get tap water? We have to run, schlep out to the middle of nowhere and get this ice and schlep it. Nobody's going to know it's from the middle of nowhere, and how are you going to know? You know, and I was surprised at the difference in the qualities of water from these various locations. And I thought they would dissipate, and they have to some extent, but it's still quite clear, the distinct sources. Now, I thought I'd introduce myself as a potential model for the future. All right, enough of this. You know, I'm a sucker for the doubling thing, but anyway, you get an idea of what the place looks like. Okay. Now, what we've got are the little landscapes that are formed at the bottom of the columns. And we're inspecting them now. This was one of my favorite experiences up there, which was the children's relationship to the environment. Not just the rubber floor, but obviously these little kind of moonscapes that formed at the bottom of each column, which I guess became a metaphor for the world. So you've probably noticed there are words in the rubber floor, and I like to think of this as the first bilingual sculpture in the world. I collected the English, and my friend Margaret Blundell selected the Icelandic words. We selected words commonly used to describe the weather. Not technical terms, but just popular terms for the weather. And what I found most riveting was the fact that the words that we selected were almost all words that would describe humanity equally as well as the weather. And especially true when it comes to sexuality and morality. It seems to be the same thing. And, you know, when I went to the dictionary, I was amazed because there was always one example about the weather. Like, okay, we can talk about thick weather or thick people. We can talk about torrid weather or torrid relationships. So it was really a one-on-one thing, which I'll get back to. So the rubber floor, the tiling of the rubber floor, you've got 2-inch thick rubber. And then you have rubber text inlaid in the rubber. So you have this collection of words in English and in Icelandic dispersed throughout the floor. Something shocking about seeing moist by itself. Anyway, you get the idea. And then you get the kind of landscape of weather, language. Another aspect of this project is the website. And this is the opening page of the website. The website is an attempt to bring together all the parts of the community center into this virtual space. And Iceland, as most islands, are very well-versed in the internet, and that's a very natural language for the community. So it was a great opportunity for me to develop a website. Now, this website locates the community center relative to the entrance to the center of the earth, the entrance to hell, my studio in New York, and the North Pole. I figured that was really all that mattered. There's on this website, I posted a lot of my own writings that I had not published before, actually kind of published the two place books, which not complete, but you have a very good sense of that project. There are a few aspects of my involvement in Iceland that are heavily documented on the website. So you have, to get into the gory details of this community center, one of the things that we are sponsoring as a community center, and when I say we, I mean Art Angel and myself and the community of Sticky Somer, we sponsor chess education for women. So we have the chess room, which is run by Guðfríður Lilja, who is the president of the Icelandic Chess Association. And she goes up there. She picks five young girls who are interested in chess, and Art Angel sponsors up to five girls, and then there's a larger grouping of kids who will go up and they'll do chess camp up there, and that's actually open to boys as well, but the sponsorships are dedicated to girls. You know, for those of you who don't know, Iceland is chess is the national sport in Iceland, and it's quite a powerful tradition there. but it's subject to the same prejudice, gender prejudice that it is pretty much everywhere. So, yeah. Then you've got, you know, the Water Selected, which you've seen, the Archive of Water. You Are the Weather Iceland, which is the rubber floor. You've got Weather Reports You, which we're going to get to, the third leg of the project. Community Center, which the Community Center being the space is open to community programming. The community has involved the space with film programming going on there, yoga classes, AA, and, you know, music, children's music classes, as far as I know. So that's the way the space has been used. And then the sixth leg of it is a writer's residency. And if you look at the facade of the building, the lower three windows, we actually renovated the space. What was a former basement, we opened it up. We created a very beautiful living space for one writer, which has this exquisite view to the ocean. So, and we have a nominating committee we put together to nominate or to select writers from the international community, Icelandic and international community. So the first writer is Gudrun Eva, Minerva's daughter. She's a young novelist from Iceland. She's in residence there until January. In the beginning of the year, we have Rebecca Solnit coming in, who is kind of a, well, I'm going to describe her as kind of a maverick essayist, writing on everything from gold mining to getting lost. We have Anne Carson coming in, who is a Canadian writer. So it's actually a program that is extremely exciting to me, and it's interwoven with public events, readings, and so on. So here's a public event. I have my German publisher decided to launch a new publication of mine out of the Library of Water in September. So we have the Her the Breathe at Home, which is a new book I completed, and it was launched here in September. That's Gerhard Steidel. And remarkably like the Russian mafia, actually. He came up there. You know, this is a town of 1,000 in a huge black suburban car. This is his driver, Frank, lovely guy. And they had these, like, hardened metal suitcases. And quite a scene. It was quite humorous. But they schlepped all these books up there. Now, this is James Lingwood, who's not a chess player, but he's very good on the cell phone. And if you look through... on the left, you see a room back there, which is what's called the listening room, which was actually not, didn't have it finished at the time of the opening. So this is kind of the third installation open to the public. It's called Weather Reports You. Weather Reports You is a basically a collective self-portrait. If such a thing is possible, we published a book which records this collected group of interviews on the premise. The interview was based on the premise of when you speak about the weather, you speak about yourself. And we went from pretty much by word of mouth throughout the local community and collected these interviews orally, transcribed them. They were collected in Icelandic. They were translated, transcribed, and we published them in English and we published them in Icelandic. And I thought I would read very briefly some of these weather reports. This is a project which most recently is going to be extended to BBC Three, radio and internet when we will, on a new chapter of this work, Weather Reports You, it will extend these reports to the British Isles. But starting now, the photographs you'll see here were taken by, I had a group of people, Utni, Uki, and Ivar, as a family unit, who went around and collected these interviews for me. And I asked them just to take a shot of whatever was in front of them when they were interviewing. Most of the interviews occurred at the gas station, which is a very typical thing of Iceland. I think the gas station is the center of the culture there. So we start with Bertna, 66-year-old librarian. Difficult experiences started when I was 3. I lost my father then. He drowned. And naturally, I've never gotten over that. When I was 12, I lost my uncle at sea, so I'm not terribly fond of storms and the sea. The weather is always connected with the sea in my mind. When the weather's bad, I always watch the sea. That's what puts the fear into me most. I get fed up with the light. I get fed up with the bright summer. I want to stay awake all night then. But I think it's a wonderful time of year that's coming now with the darkness. There's a little bit of a twist to all this, because if it's dark, I don't need to roam around and be with other people. Typical librarian, wouldn't you say? Hang on, the next one. Here we have Holmfrieder. He's 80 years old. The most memorable weather is the summers when the grass is growing and the meadows and pastures are turning green. I think it's the most important and best for farmers to have good weather at lambing time. Farmers need good weather in lambing time when the sheep come out with their little lambs. Svanborg, 60 years old. She is the owner of a tourist boat. You can always find something good about the weather here in Stikkisommer. I've always said that it's always calm here, but the calm just moves by varying amounts. The Lord above can't always please everybody, so I don't get annoyed if it's not always the way I want it. That's why it's always good. I just don't let weather have an effect on me, except maybe for my laundry, because the washing smells so nice. And I love it when I get to dry it outside. This is Eil, 16 years old. The best weather is the weather I can play basketball in. The worst weather is when I can't play basketball. Elverun, 18 years old, fish factory worker. I can't recall any serious weather here. No, I don't think so. But Jesus, when I got confirmed, the weather was so crazy then I had to put a bag over my head. You know, my hairdo just wouldn't stay in place. It nearly blew away. There was so much wind I had to fight my way to church. Margaret is a post office worker, 55 years old. I started working for the post in Hveragerði when I was 12. Once I was delivering the mail in a big snowstorm and blizzard, and I took a shortcut in the village. I was so tired, I'd almost finished, and I thought to myself, I'll just have a quick lie down here. And I fell asleep. Then I woke up with a bulldozer clearing the snow close by. The snow had drifted right over me. That's how people freeze to death, but I woke up. Afterwards, I started thinking about what would happen if I'd been somewhere with no traffic. Walking in a snowstorm, you just feel tiredness coming on, and oh, it's so nice to have a lie down. Several years ago, I was very depressive. This is Anna. 45 years old. She's a nurse at St. Francis Hospital. Several years ago, I was very depressive. I often used to think then that you just don't know what comes first, the chicken or the egg, whether the weather affects my depression or whether I'm depressed all the time. And I remember at that time I was shut in here by myself a lot. But if I'm in my stride, I feel good in a snowstorm. For example, the best thing I know is going swimming in drifting snow and blizzards, swimming like mad, and then getting into a hot pot at the swimming pool, feeling those extremes, the heat and the cold. Then maybe one day I wake up and there's the sort of weather and it's totally repellent. And the last one I'll read is from Johan, who's 88 years old. He passed away since the interview was taken. He was a lighthouse keeper up in the northernmost part of Iceland, which is inaccessible by road, so quite remote. When I was at the Horn Lighthouse, everything revolved around the weather. I could almost say that I shifted my position in my chair according to the weather. I could feel it all, the weather and weather measurements. I had to record the weather at three-hour intervals round the clock for 25 years. I had to go up onto the mountain every single day, whatever the weather. So I ought to have some definition of the changeability of weather, but I'm such a blockhead. It's a fact that even if you do something daily that has an effect on you, it's as if it never sticks in your mind, unless you're hit over the head. But sometimes I feel my whole life was more or less spent in danger. This is just an ambient shot of the interior of the Library of Water, and that is my last shot. Thank you.
Moderated discussion, and then we'll open it up to the audience if there are any questions. The Library of Water is really, you know, as you were talking about it, to me is really a testament to your love of Iceland and the way in which the landscape, the weather, and the water has affected your life and your work. You also mentioned, and I mentioned, the encyclopedic volumes that you've been working on, Two Place, since 1990, dedicated to Iceland. And you commented that the reason you titled it Two Place is because you think of Iceland as a verb rather than a noun. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that's sort of pretty self-explanatory. I mean, this idea of identity, which is not a fixed thing. So, you know, you think of geography, geez, you think this island, well, it's an island, it's a fixed thing, but in my life, you know, you just watch how the map has changed. It's kind of amazing. I mean, it's really almost accelerated the rate of change, not just the naming of things, but the way we relate to ourselves, or I feel that deeply in myself, but... So Two Places, really just kind of focusing on, you know, I decided I'd do a project in real time, and so I've been working on it since 1990, so that's one idea of real time. Obviously, very fugitive things are real time, too, but I wanted peace of my life, so this is an ongoing project, and it gave me a kind of a scale of event that would allow me to engage the subtleties of identity without being didactic or descriptive. So, that's
it. Seems like with the Library of Water and with other works like Stillwater, there's an impulse to classify, to know the unquantifiable or the unknowable. I'm wondering if maybe you can comment on that impulse.
Well, I think the idea of classification is no more than an idea. It's maybe it's an entrance. Obviously, the idea of archiving water is the ultimate absurdity. It's also kind of the end game. If you imagine that a number of these glaciers that you saw, that I was collecting, are close to non-existent now, you understand the relationship to the archive. As far as actually naming unnameable things, I'm not good at that. I just I like to play with words, but I don't claim to identify the unnameable.
As you mentioned several times, the weather and the environment is a topic very much on our minds. And do you think your responsibility as an artist vis-a-vis this topic, has it changed your practice at all?
I can't imagine that the issue of the weather hasn't changed all of our lives. So I have no question that it's factored deeply into my work. How to talk about that, I'm not completely clear, but this is an issue that I wake up with every day. I think I started worrying about the weather when I was about 6 or 7 years old, so I'm not new to this anxiety, but it's really powerful today. How it's affected my drawing practice, for example, I think it's kind of a moot thing. I probably draw for different reasons today than I did 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. My anxieties are different, and the weather has a lot to do with that.
Uh-huh. So. Speaking of drawing, I read somewhere that you said drawing is your primary activity. Can you comment on that?
Yeah,
I
think drawing is a very broad act. It applies to every medium. It has a place in every medium and most forms, whether you're writing or you're making a film or you're playing music or certainly photography. The act of drawing is very much a part of these larger activities. And drawing is a word that applies as a verb very broadly, on a very simple level. It is a word applied to many dialectic activities that apply to pretty much everything I do, one of which is actually physically drawing in the traditional sense of making drawings. But I consider that drawing enters into my photography, in the editing, in the manner in which I compose many images into one experience. That's all somehow related to a drawing activity. The sculpture as well, learning about all the things not to do, that's a drawing activity. You know, there's a lot that I figured out I shouldn't do. And mostly I think that's been a positive thing. So drawing is kind of a process of extraction, discovery, editing, relation. It's a very broad term for me that has enabled me to engage many different idioms.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I really love about your work is that there seems to be no hierarchy. And regardless of the form or of the medium, there is a kind of multiplicity. And certainly in the photographic work, you sort of resist the idea of a photograph as one moment frozen in time. And many of your photographic installations, indeed, have multiple images that are a fraction of a second apart. Mm. Can you maybe comment on that a little bit?
The photography, When I look at my work now, of course, retrospectively, you kind of see these things, but I would say that my sculpture and my photography are the works of somebody who's been drawing all their life. Mm-hmm. And the photography, I would say, is I would never describe myself as a photographer except in a nominal sense, and that is the sense of working with images. But I'm not specifically interested in the act of taking a photograph, the mechanics and the technical aspect of that. I know enough about it to engage it conceptually, but the real focus is towards, you know, the relationship to the audience, and the work I tend to do, the important photographic works are architecturally based, they're edited. You know, we're often dealing with up to 100 images, so you're dealing with an editing technique and a composing and an installation, which are as important to the final work as the image itself. So, mm-hmm. And that's true as well in the sculpture, although, you know, the sculpture is highly distilled and object-oriented, it's never separate from its setting. Or let's say when I develop a sculptural work, it's always in relationship to the viewer and the setting, the physical setting. That's actually where you come up with the pairing, the paired forms. That's why the paired forms, because you have the chance to engage the viewer as part of the form.
Yeah, actually, I didn't touch on that at all, and you did a little bit in your talk, in that a lot of your work has had this form of the pairing. And it seems to me that that's something that's evolved over the years as you've worked in a variety of materials and forms. What does that pairing or doubling, what does that really mean to you? And how is it, why is it so central to your practice?
I think it's just always good to be more than one. I mean, you know, you can intellectualize it in a million different directions.
Sure.
You could say it's, you know, some people think it's because I'm gay. Some people think it's because I'm a formalist. Some people think, you know, it really, pairing is a way of creating a space that isn't easily quantified because it includes the viewer. So if you see, look at a piece like Dead Owl, where you've got two identical images, no one believes they're identical, and they just spend all their time figuring out the difference. So that's kind of the beginning of infinity, is looking for that space that allows you to query the world, in a sense. So for me, it's a way of creating an entrance into a way of acknowledging the viewer, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing that I didn't touch on, and you didn't get a chance to touch on, was the importance of portraiture in your work. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Well, you know, when you, at least maybe you don't know because, well, I know the way I work. There's just a lot of discovery, and sometimes you discover things you've known all your life, but it's just somehow the way you come upon it, it's new. You enter a space that you maybe have lived in all your life, but you enter it in a way that's unfamiliar, which gives you a kind of a new relationship to it, in a sense. And this is what's happened to me in the portraits, what has become a kind of portraiture vein in my work. I didn't set out to, and I never really thought, oh, that I was particularly interested in portraiture. It was a very... it was a very kind of subterranean activity that evolved. Now here I am in 2007, and I look at my work and I see that some significant percentage is really a kind of portraiture, whether it's This Is Me, This Is You, or whether it's Dead Owl, which I think of as a self-portrait, or whether it's A-Sphere, which I also think of as a self-portrait. The Weather Reports You, a collective self-portrait, which I ghost produced. So there are a lot of ways at getting at likeness or semblance without actually identifying any one particular, you know, keeping it open, but somehow arriving at that moment of recognition. without the name. So.
Well, one of the things I loved that you said about how the way in which we talk about the weather reflects something about ourselves. And if I may, if I can put you on the spot, I wonder if you have any story about the weather that's personal to you that you might relate to us.
Well, the one personal story I had about the weather I published a year ago, so it's published now. But I have had a lot of kind of confrontational moments in Iceland with the weather. And again, getting back to that criminal adrenaline that is probably one of the hidden reasons I go to Iceland. But the one that probably got me on the course to where I am now is when I was a kid, and it was third grade, and my teacher, Mrs. Griffin, said, "Well, there's a hurricane coming," and she dismissed the class and she said, "Run home." And I just thought to myself, you know, what if I don't make it? You know, it's like. So I ran home, you know. So everybody ran home. I couldn't believe it. You're telling me to run home? This is a hurricane? I'm supposed to run home? Anyway, I got home, and I was, you know, home alone. And we had this huge picture window in the living room. And I was crouched underneath it and just watched. And the hurricane came, and it was unbelievably dramatic and scary and all of that. It was kind of green and out there, and... Yeah, it was very impressive. So, you know, that just the politics of running home and trying to beat out the hurricane, and you know, so that was it.
Well, I think we probably have a few minutes for some questions from the audience, if there are any.
Beautiful. Did you have any feelings about it as it melted? Did you have any emotional, moments of that?
To be honest with you, I don't know that I was around for most of it. Because we were running on a 24-hour schedule, melting ice. But no, I'm interested in, I kind of stick to what's going on in front of me. I love the ice and I love the water. So I was interested in both sides of it. I think the thing that I was most fascinated by and is deeply fascinating about water, that it has these different identities. So I was just as curious about the water as I was about the ice.
Yes.
Is that what drew you to Iceland? I mean, did you know what you were getting into 25 years ago or 30 years when you decided to go there? I mean, sort of who would go to Iceland, you know?
Really. I definitely didn't know what I was getting into. And I went there with a friend who took that early photograph that I showed. That was, she insisted on that, taking that photograph. So, and I've never shown it. I've had it in my archive. Well, 1975, and I thought I would enjoy exposing myself at this phase of the game and seeing how that came out. But that and I was really shocked at how incredible the resemblance is between Iceland and myself. I think that was what I was shocked by. When I look at that photo, I think, God, Iceland looks just like me. So, I've traveled... not exactly everywhere in Iceland, but pretty much everywhere I could get to. Car, foot, or motorcycle, depending on what year I was traveling. I never intended for Iceland to become something in my life. It was it evolved into this migratory thing. Tomorrow, I don't know whether I'll wake up and decide it's over. You know, I really never said, oh, this is, you know, you got to do this project, you lay this out. I don't know if that project's finished. The ninth volume may be it. But maybe there's another volume out there, and I love that relationship to things that the scale of event is not clear, you know. So And I guess that this project, the Library of Water, was a difficult thing for me psychologically because it's the first time I committed to produce something in Iceland. Up till now, I've been out there pretty solitary and kind of taking my work and going home and producing it over the years. Like some of these pieces, like Doubt Box, the images were collected over 10 years. I have this archive that I kind of will go into for new work, even a lot of material that I've never done anything with, you know. Depending on what, like Doubt by Water, which I showed at the Whitney a few years ago, I knew what I had in the archive. I knew what I wanted to do, so it all came together. But I started taking those photographs in 1990 with no agenda, no idea, you know, what I was going to do with them. And then eventually developed a concept in which some of these images made sense and was able to create a kind of a framework for them. So the bird heads and the unbelievably exquisite, you know, it's very hard to use an image of something that's so beautiful like the icebergs. So you really had to place it. So I thought it was good with the concrete water, with this water that is beautiful but disturbing. Deeply, when you're actually on the river, it's a deeply disturbing quality. And I think why I was drawn to it. And then the images of this young person who I've worked with for 10 years, actually. And I've been photographing him over the years, and a lot of this material I never use. And when I put this together, this project together, I saw an opportunity to work with his face. This is the second group of work that I've done where he factors in. So,
on the corner.
Are you looking forward to other artists coming to Iceland, such as Yoko Ono's new installation that's opening up in November that she said is going to be shown for the next 5 years outside of Reykjavik, which is not probably very far from the library?
Well, I mean, I think artists have been going to Iceland. They've always been attracted to Iceland. There's a whole tradition for people going there and working there. But and in that sense, there's nothing unique about what I'm doing there. But to be honest with you, I don't, in general, and this is not about Yoko Ono, but I don't feel like Iceland needs outdoor sculpture. And I personally am not interested in contributing to that tradition. So to be really frank with you, no, I'm not interested. And I've seen it, so it's already up, and it looks like a car dealership. It's basically a light flashing up from the ground at night, and I kid you not, when I came in from the airport last time, which was in September, it was working. I asked the taxi driver, I said, "What is that light?" And he said he didn't know. And then I realized that it was on. It's just outside of Reykjavik. It's on Vive, and it was Yoko Ono's light. And you know, if you didn't know it was Yoko Ono's light, you would think somebody was selling cars. So you have to go and see the landscape, and then you can kind of figure out what really makes sense. But I don't get the idea of art in that landscape. It doesn't. Not this kind of art. I mean, I can imagine doing things in that landscape, but people go out and they do these large projects, these public art projects, but I'm somebody who thinks public art, 99% of it should be banned. And I even think when I left college and I came down to New York and I saw the public art here, I thought, you know, how could I ever be a sculptor? This is just so depressing. Really, I thought, you know, the public interfaces with this stuff, they're going to think, how could they have any respect for what you know, because I came out of Yale as a sculptor. And to this day, I refuse to produce work for sculpture gardens. So, yeah, I'm a tyrant. There are a lot of things I think should be banned.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.